Welcome to the International Connection. Today we continue with our interview with and dialogue with Lyndon LaRouche from his jail cell in Alexandria, Virginia. Mr. LaRouche, we ended off last week talking about the IMF debt for land, wilderness land swap. Just before we get into that, Bucky Fuller was very prominent in the 60s and 70s, and he generated he was interpreted as a cultural optimist based on the man's ability to make and invent new technological environments. How would you distinguish yourself from his cultural optimism?
I didn't catch that.
Buckminster Fuller.
Oh, well, not, yes, in general, but not entirely. He was an interesting fellow.
You mean not entirely you would separate, or you would...
I would say some points of agreement, some points of interest. But his essential starting point is different. He was an old-fashioned fellow, and it defined his sense of achievements in those terms, many of which I found agreeable.
Old-fashioned in what sense?
Well, the old-fashioned side of technological progress, you know, the size of achievement. He would build things, and he liked to build things or cause them to be built with innovations. He explored things. He experimented.
Yes.
And that's from a different standpoint than I would, but I'm not unhappy with anyone who experiments and builds things.
Yes.
I think that's a positive thing relative to what we see flourishing today.
Well, how would you distinguish yourself from him then? What was your style?
Philosophically, for example, even on geometry, which is, of course, one of the areas he's concerned with, on architecture.
Oh, yes.
I've been involved in some of these things because in projecting a... certain research near the asteroid belt, I had to provide a base for it. So I had to worry about a colony, a permanent one on Mars. And in worrying about a permanent one on Mars, I had to be responsible by defining what a habitation on Mars would be like. Taking advantage of things like some of my friends who had done the work for NASA and other institutions on the Moon project. And therefore, I had to involve myself in more seriously in architecture and city planning than I had before, which impelled me to look at cities in the Sahara, which impelled me to look at old cities like Siena and so forth in Europe with new eyes, that is, cities which had been planned on principle that lasted for a long time and which had functional as well as visual beauty in their organization. So it's my standpoint in that respect is different than his. My standpoint is more that of Leonardo da Vinci than his.
Well, what is that standpoint? I'm not sure the...
Well, the harmonics, the living processes are defined by these nonlinear harmonics characterized by the metrical characteristics of the golden section projections.
Right. Would you say that he was more of a linear type then?
Yes, right.
I see.
We take Kepler's. You can take all the work of Buckminster Fuller in respect to architecture, similar geometric propositions, and look at the published works of Kepler on as they bear on geometry and geometries, and compare them. And to me, the distinction is quite clear.
All right. Now, I noticed in your TV special on A Woman on Mars, you did have geodesic dome designs for the living spaces on Mars. I mean, that was Bucky Fuller's invention, right?
Well, I didn't actually do that. What I did was did the configurations. And then some artist decided they used Buckminster Fuller's geodesics as a way of implementing what I had specified. And I thought, well, fine, that's amusing. That's not... unsound.
Well, do you think Bucky Fuller was used by the Cheney Foundation in the oligarchic paradigm shift?
Well, I don't know. It's sense. The Cheney Foundation, interestingly enough, has been poking around on my work on harmonics recently.
Is that right?
Yes. They're sort of a cultural collecting society, typically Venetian. They're run by the local abbot, Benedictine abbot runs that thing on that island.
In Venice.
Yeah, right, on the San Giorgio.
Yes.
Venice has been a place where they collect the works or samples of the works of all kinds of people, including their traditional enemies, just to have the archive there, one copy of everything, sort of a Noah's Ark of every species of idea of friend and adversary. So that, well, sure, they would play with him.
Well, that's encyclopedic tradition, isn't it? The idea of collecting things and really not moving into new invisible realms of technology.
Well, they probably, if they caught me dead, they'd probably stuff me and put me on exhibit someplace.
In Venice.
Right, something like that. Yes.
But that's another point, is the Aristotelian tradition is encyclopedic, and the Platonic tradition, which you're part of, is not encyclopedic.
That's exactly right.
And nominalism comes out of the encyclopedic tradition, because you're sort of worshipping the names for things, the labels for things, and missing the process. Now, I think I have the quote here, which describes very nicely your... expression of this. No, I don't have that. Let's just go back while I look for it. We were talking about Bucky Fuller as a linear physicist or a linear architect. How is the nonlinear aspects that you... When did you get into the nonlinear parts? In the 60s? When was that discovered?
Oh, I've always been concerned with nonlinear things ever since I first was exposed to it about puberty. I don't think it had anything to do with puberty. It's just that... I was confronted by this notion through my work on Leibniz and a number of things of Leibniz on his philosophical works in particular, such as the theodicy, the monadology, and the treatment of the monadology.
Well, what is the nonlinear?
Well, essentially what this involves is how is number defined, how is space, purely a continuum space, quantized, questions of scale, all that sort of thing. Essentially, it arises as a constructed geometric notion that if we start with a continuum, which is based initially on the root idea of circular action and takes into account the non-algebraic curvature, which is derived from circular action, that what you generate is a continuum in which what appear to be mathematical discontinuities are lawfully generated in a harmonic way. The result is...
Harmonic, you mean musical?
Harmonic in the same sense that Kepler or Plato would use the term harmonic.
All right.
That, therefore, as Cantor's theorem, of course, was that given a mathematical process which was physically continuous, then in that case, the number of discontinuities which lie between any two points in the continuum are innumerable, implicitly innumerable. Then there's a more general formulation, which is what I worked on, is that given a continuum which is undergoing a phase change, a Riemann surface type of function, that the rate of change of density of singularities within an interval is implicitly innumerable. So any process which is characterized by these kinds of apparent mathematical discontinuities as an integral part of an actually physically continuous function, that any process of that type is what we would probably call a nonlinear function.
I see.
Nonlinear is sometimes used in other ways to simplify merely transcendental functions, which are not truly nonlinear. Transcendental functions, like the so-called trigonometric and related functions.
Yes.
Which are not nonlinear in the true sense. It's the non-algebraic functions, which are the true nonlinears.
Are you familiar with McLuhan talking about acoustic space versus visual space, and that acoustic space was nonlinear, and that the electric environment had this acoustic space, maybe not technically harmonic, but a sense of musical view of the universe under electric conditions? Are you familiar with that?
No, but I would say that's not true.
Because it's based on sensory data?
No, that acoustical phenomena are electromagnetic. It's not in Maxwell's electromagnetism, but in electromagnetism as such. This is where we get the nonlinearity in nonlinear functions in spectroscopy today are associated with overcoming experimentally the misconceptions which are associated with Maxwell's electromagnetism.
I see. All right, I found the quote that relates to this. You say in... There's another book called Will the Soviets Rule During the 1980s? That title is an accurate prediction, isn't it?
Not so much the Soviets as such, but that's a catchy title, and I think an appropriate one.
Yes.
Essentially, we're talking about, are there those in the West who, as they did in the trust phenomenon of the 1921-27 period in the United States and Britain, are they prepared to enter into the kind of partnership with Moscow, which in effect leans toward establishing a world federalist condominium, which is sort of divide the world between an Eastern and a Western division of a one world empire. And that's what I was concerned about.
Yeah, and you wrote this book around 1980, and right. You would say that happened. It's happening now.
That is what is happening. That's what Kissinger's current policy is.
Yes. All right, here's the quote in that book. In the Platonic view, as replicated in the metaphysics of Ibn Sina and reviewed by Kuza and others, the universe is primarily a continuous process of creative self-development. This is what you mean by negentropy.
Yeah.
The apparent laws of the universe in any of its aspects or phases at any point in time may indeed appear to be of the fixed form associated with a domain governed by a fixed physical action characteristic. However, such fixed laws are nonetheless relatively ephemeral, in the same sense that we have an empirical succession of inorganic living processes and reason in the development of our planet. Each of the latter three domains of planetary activity are distinguished by different fundamental characteristics, and yet the various domains are mutually efficient in respect of causality, and the higher domains have emerged from self-development within the lower. These Riemannian domains are multiply connected. Now, that relates to your notion of causality. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Oh, this is a problem which I maybe reference a current problem which concerns me very much. To put it in formal terms, the Riemann surface function is an adequate representation, in general, of the pathway a process must take, a nonlinear process must take, in the course of proceeding from one phase space to a lower or higher one. But the fact that this shows itself to be the possible route of development does not mean necessarily that it occurs. So the question is, what would cause the fact that something should or could happen is not sufficient reason for it to actually happen. So the question is, what is the causal driver which would cause these changes to occur?
Yes.
Now, therefore, I've placed emphasis on the contributions of Eugenio Beltrami, who was a collaborator of Riemann and who raised this question with him in a very meaningful way, is how do we introduce the negative curvature problem, as Beltrami defined it, into the Riemann surface function to generate what might be called a Riemann-Beltrami surface function.
Who called it that?
I would.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I mean, if you do what Beltrami proposed, as I view it must be done, I would say, well, what we're talking about here is what we would call a Riemann-Beltrami function.
Yes.
The Riemann work is, we don't throw it out, we recognize what the modification is that has to be introduced. As Beltrami indicated, how you deal with a Riemann surface function to project a negative curvature on it, which takes us into all these wonderful isochrones, tautochrones, and synchrones generally in geometry. And so the question of causality to me is located fundamentally not in what causes one particle to bump against another, but rather in those processes or laws which govern the way one kind of phase space is transformed into a different, higher quality of phase space. And the sense that negentropy, or the increase of higher states of organization of the universe, is the general driving force which drives the universe.
And the hypothesis, the higher hypothesis, means not finding fixed systems that everything has to be fit into or imposed upon. There is an open-endedness to your view of how to...
There are laws which govern the way new laws must be formed. That is, the universe does not create new laws in the sense of laws of phase states arbitrarily. But there is an ordering principle which governs what is the solution in terms of a higher phase state for the limits of an existing phase state.
And that's a continuously refined process because you find new factors involved in that.
I'll give an example of this. The best example is, take the isochronic curve. If I were to represent relativity, special relativity, adequately, which a friend of mine is supposed to be working on in dealing with the problems of the orbit of Mercury, then what I should do is take an envelope, a Leibniz-Huygens Monge type of envelope, for a series of isochronic curves of different curvature. Or we could do this with the catenaries, for example.
Yes.
And with that kind of envelope, or a pair of such envelopes, with certain qualifications I'm going to go into here, but a pair of such envelopes gives us a series of non-algebraic numbers implicitly, or numbers which define ordering of non-algebraic numbers, by which we can define in a better, more efficient, more direct way the special relativity characteristics of a phase space. But the underlying thing here is this. If a law of the universe is truly a law of the physical universe, under the conditions that laws of the universe can, particular laws of the universe, can evolve, then for a law of the universe to be efficient, it must be efficient isochronically throughout the universe. So the conception of law from this standpoint, of this, of situating the notion of law in such higher order envelopes of isochronic possibilities, that is what I mean by, in physics terms, of a hypothesis of the higher hypothesis.
I see. Now, in the, I've studied a bit of anthropology. Have you ever read the author Edward T. Hall?
The
book was The Hidden Dimension was one of them, The Silent Language. He goes into how the confusion in the United Nations or between different business people around the world, when they confront another culture, for example, Arabs like to stand closer to Westerners than Westerners are used to. You know that kind of anthropological discussion gestural communication, which causes confusion between cultures. Like certain cultures, if you touch them on the shoulder, it means something totally different than what we would mean in our context. What do you think of that kind of knowledge brought into the political?
I think it's really not too important. As a matter of fact, if it becomes functionally important, it's because you haven't done the most important thing. Essentially, all human beings are the same. Essentially. Huh?
Though there is a lot of schools of thought that would disagree with that,
that's right?
Cultural relativism.
They're all the same. Now, to establish that sameness, in fact, you have to come to an agreement about what is really important about another person or yourself.
Hmm? Yes.
And if the two of you agree about what's important about all human beings, then you find in each other that which you love and admire the most. Now, if you've done that sort of thing, if you say, all right, we're human, your child is human, I enjoy the development of your child, even though you come from a different culture as much as a child from my culture, I get pleasure from seeing your child develop.
Yes.
Then you don't care about these secondary nuisances so much. And if they come up, if they become bothersome, you can cope with them from a higher standpoint. I'd like to write to you, I have many of my friends who say come from Buddhist cultures in Asia.
Yes.
So shall I let the differences among different kinds of Buddhist culture, and they have some pretty strong ones, as between the lesser vehicle and greater vehicle,
yeah,
or between the Japan variety of Buddhists and some others I know. Shall I let that stand in between us and let these little bothersome details, differentia of habit, get between us? I have to be a little bit sensitive, watch for them, be aware of them, learn about them, recognize them when they occur. But if we are, my friend and I, in each of these cases, if we understand what is fundamentally important about being human, we have something which ties us together so strongly that these little secondary problems we work out quite comfortably.
Right, so that without an understanding in our education of the basics, that's why cultural relativism and the thought forms that come out of that get in the way, kind of a, you know, smoke in the eyes.
What parent who loves a child wishes the child to live with a 25 or 30-year life expectancy of misery? And if the culture in which they're misery, and they find that in our culture we can give them something which leads in a different direction, most of them would be quite happy with that. It's a matter of showing love and respect for people of different cultures, showing what we call goodwill. And if we have something to give them, and we give it to them in that spirit, they generally will receive it in that spirit. There may be a lot of fussing about that, but we fuss with our closest friends about ideas when we really like each other. But we'll get into terrible fights about things which we finally come to agreement on. And what's wrong with that?
Right, so that's why you would disagree with such approaches, strategies as appropriate technologies.
Correct.
That follow, that's where you're exaggerating.
I like to see a human mind develop. I like to see a child playing with blocks, and that like to see the light illuminating the entire personality of that child with joy. When the child realizes that it has made a discovery, which is its own original discovery as far as it's concerned. It wasn't taught it discovery. It learned it by itself through its own powers, and it sits there in absolute delight that it's learned a new, what it is for that child, a new principle. I love that. And I think most other people love that in human beings. And
you don't think that kind of knowledge is culturally conditioned in the West to be a Western form of knowledge?
No, it's not. It's not as such. All over the world, I see people in Africans, I've seen Indians, I've seen Southeast Asians and so forth. And it's a universal thing. Anyone who loves their children, as we love our children, even in their own terms of reference, the very possibility of the kind of love which is called in the original New Testament Greek, which is called agape, or in Latin caritas, or in the King James version is called charity. That quality of love expressed by a parent toward a child, in any culture in which that is a value, we have immediately, in terms of that point of reference, something in common to work from.
I see. All right. Now, have you read much of William Irwin Thompson's literature that comes out of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York?
I don't get into that sort of thing much from those sources.
Yeah, you don't read their literature.
And the Lindisfarne stuff in particular throws me off. That's Satanist. I can't stand.
In what sense does it throw you off, though?
Well, because it's Satanist. The Gregory Bateson operation. You know, Gregory Bateson. I last ran into Bateson. I didn't actually go down to see him because I abhorred the fellow. But I was meeting actually with some industrialists from Detroit, auto industry and so forth.
This is in the 70s.
It's 78. And downstairs, of course, my people, I was doing a security check in the hotel. And
yes.
Because unpleasant fellows who would like to have me removed from this planet service. And they said, oh, we got a problem now. Says, what is the problem? We got Gregory Bateson downstairs. Oh, he is a problem. What's he doing? He's lecturing on witches. So one of our people gained admission to the meeting to audit what this fellow was whooping up below. And he was giving a lecture on witches. He was traveling the United States organizing for the Wicca cult. And then, of course, we know what goes on in the crypts and down underneath the Cathedral of St. John. About every heathen atrocity in the world is represented in those little chapels.
Yes.
So,
well, do you have proof of that?
Oh, yes, we have eyewitness sort of thing. We had a fellow who was attending a rally. He got himself all up in this great cloak thing for the moaning and groaning down there in the basement at one of these installation ceremonies for new members of the venerable and hospitaller order, you know.
Yeah, the Knights of Malta.
Yeah, or the Anglo-American version.
Right? Yes.
And it was a terrible moaning and groaning, but his presence was discovered, and he was scampering out there through the premises. He pursued by some fellows who appeared intent on homicide. So we've seen these sorts of things, and we know Bishop Paul Moore very well, including the embarrassing fact that he was a co-sponsor of the formation of Jim Jones' People's Temple.
Well, what is it? He doesn't sue you about the accusations.
Why, how could he? It's all factual. Published by the... For example, they've held press conferences to announce the Wicca cult's installation in the basement of the cathedral. So here's the leading Satan cult of the United States as its headquarters officially in the basement of the cathedral.
It's Episcopalian, the cathedral?
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a great riot, you know, in the Episcopalian Anglican ranks generally.
A great what?
A riot.
A riot? You mean
a real debate. Schismatic riot among those who like the common book of prayer and those who... would rather have the Alexandrian Gnostic Gospels.
All right.
With women priests and who knows what else going on.
All right. Now, the reason I bring up William Thompson is that he would have a different view of the evolution of technology coming out of primitive food-gathering societies than into agricultural societies. You have a different view of those origins. Does it originate in the sea?
Not exactly. It may or may not. It obviously has to in some sense. But take a very simple calculation. It's not with physical economy. Take the Cainozoic period, by which we know something, and we can compare that with some modern cases, or relatively modern cases, on animal populations and so forth.
What was that case?
The Cainozoic period.
Okay.
You know, the relevant period of human existence are scattered among the various ice ages.
Right, the Cenozoic period.
Right, right. Well, I guess that's become now precious. I suppose one should say the modern period. I don't know, but I was educated in an old period, and I keep saying Cainozoic.
All right.
So you can estimate, you know, about 10 square kilometers per average land area of the planet required per individual. Now you say, how do you get from that level, which is life expectancy well below 20 years of age? Monstrous condition of human society, more precariously situated than troops of baboons. How do you get from that to something which resembles civilization? Well, from a simple standpoint of efficient energy density per hectare per capita, you can't. So the evolution of agricultural society from a primitive hunting and gathering society is just not possible, except in one case. The only case that's possible is through the aid of fishing. And with thicker advantages around the mouths of major river systems in those periods.
So a seafaring culture.
What would tend to become a seafaring culture. And then we have something more concrete, necessary speculation, necessary reason. You have once you get out of this biblical archaeology of the 19th century and early 20th, trying to pick Usher's date and date creation to exactly some time of the day on 4000 B.C., 4 B.C., that we find that we have a very interesting situation at about 6 to 4000 B.C. in Central Asia with a very highly developed culture as attested by the accurate astronomical information in some Vedic hymns.
Yes.
And these, which involve very low solar cycles, and so we say that astronomy did not begin with lunacy, it began with solar calendars, astronomical calendars. And lunar calendars are something that came later and very specific. So we do know that from that standpoint and other evidence that maritime cultures are the most natural vector of development of human society. And things leading into maritime cultures and the development of a riparian or analogous type of culture out of maritime culture is also the case. To develop, for example, it's a long story, but the tracing of the history of seed stock, of types of seed stocks, we find there are a few common points which are fairly well attributed to show that a distribution of seed stocks, which is necessary for an agricultural society, developed by a maritime society. And so we can see that picture fairly clearly. There is a process of development, not a Darwinian natural selection process. Darwinian natural selection is impossible in physical economy, whereas what seems to be the case, as all the evidence tends in that direction. Even Thor Heyerdahl came around to that point of view gradually on, for example, the case of the boldly suggesting, perhaps for him, that the Mesopotamian culture was an outgrowth of the pre-Aryan Indus Valley Society.
Pre-what?
Pre-Aryan Andes, Indus River Society. These Mohenjo-Daro, Harappa, so on.
Yes.
Which, I guess, is fairly late. We can date some things earlier, which appears to be originally Dravidian. But it appears to be also very much a maritime culture, going a little bit beyond what he's willing to concede. But nonetheless, this is all the evidence points in that direction.
So that those cultures that worked with the sea or were not as landlocked as other cultures would make the technological leaps.
To fish, the higher energy density, very simple problem. Where do you get food? For example, to the degree that there were Arctic cultures during the Ice Age period where the Arctic region was not glaciated, but the adjoining land masses were. As a matter of fact, what was the equivalent of the Gulf Stream during those periods warmed up the Arctic region so that it was more or less habitable, but it still had the calendar characteristics of that period, apart from the tilting of the pole, that sort of thing. But the only kind of culture that can survive under those conditions and can do quite well would be a fishing culture, a maritime fishing culture.
All right, we've come to the end of another section of our interview with Lyndon LaRouche. That's the International Connection for this week. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock for more Dialogue with Lyndon LaRouche. I'm Bob Marshall for CKLN.